From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Late one night, when B.J. Miller was a college sophomore, he climbed onto the top of a commuter train parked for the night and was electrocuted.
My body was literally smoking.
He survived, but lost both legs below the knee and half of one arm. Coming close to death and dealing with pain and disability led him to become a doctor specializing in hospice and palliative care. Today we'll talk about his experiences as a patient and survivor, and as a doctor helping people with their physical, emotional, and spiritual pain at the end of their lives.
But when it is my time to go, when I'm actually dying, I reserve the right to freak out.
He co-wrote the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan tells us her top 10 books of the year. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, B.J. Miller, is a hospice and palliative care doctor who got into this work because he came close to death when he was a sophomore at Princeton University. It was late one night, he was out with friends, and as they crossed the railroad track, he climbed on top of a two-car commuter train parked for the night and was immediately electrocuted by 11,000 volts. The damage resulted in the loss of both legs below the knees and half of an arm. Miller is now a palliative care physician at the University of California San Francisco Cancer Center. He was the executive director of San Francisco's Zen Hospice Project from 2011 to 2016. He's the co-author, with Shoshana Berger, of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. And he started a new project, the Center for Dying and Living. Now in its early stage, it's a website designed for people to share their own stories related to living with illness, disability, and loss, or caring for those who are. B.J. Miller, welcome to Fresh Air. If you don't mind, let's start with the experience that brought you close to death. You and your friends had some drinks when you were in college. It was like 4 a.m. And you climbed on top of a two-car shuttle train in Princeton. Do you remember what you were thinking when you climbed on the train?
You know, I don't. I don't really have many memories of the night itself, just sort of spotty ones. But I can very easily imagine what I was thinking. And having talked to my buddies who, over the years, we've kind of patched it all together. And I think the basic thing we were thinking was, here's a jungle gym just sitting here. Let's climb it like you'd climb a tree or something like that. I'm quite certain we did not think we were doing anything spectacularly dangerous.
Did your friends who were with you describe to you later what they witnessed? Because you have no memory of it.
Mm-hmm. Once I was through much of the trauma, it just became sort of, the whole thing just became interesting to me. And so, talking and piecing it together with the nurses who were in the burn unit when I arrived, or the ED when I arrived, but most importantly with my friends that night, Pete and Jonathan in particular. So I just happened to be the first one up, and they didn't see anything. There was a big explosion, a big flash of light, and I was thrown, I don't know how many feet, but quite some distance, happened to land on top of the train still, on my head, apparently, bumped my head, so it was bleeding. And so Pete scrambled up on top of the train behind me to see what had happened. By the way, at great risk to himself. I mean, obviously something was amiss up on top of the train, and there was no telling whether it was still alive or what was going on, but Pete kept coming. And meanwhile, Jonathan ran to the nearest telephone to dial 911. Anyway, so Pete got up there and found me lying still and bleeding from the head. And that seemed to be the big injury, was my head was bleeding like stink. But then he noticed I was smoking too. I mean, my body was literally smoking, steam coming out off of me. And Pete ran over to me and sort of, I don't know exactly, but shook me. And I came to, but I came to in a very violent way, as happens with electrical injuries, because it gets a little grotesque, but the energy, the heat, the electricity enters your body. It is, think of it as something running around inside of you. And so you burn from the inside out. And so with all this heat trapped in you, you are on fire inside. And the huge adrenaline surges, apparently. I mean, you get violent. So I am swinging. I'm punching Pete. I am swinging wildly, flailing around. And Pete's trying to hold me down so I don't roll off the train and make everything worse. And thank God. I mean, he held me down. Jonathan got the ambulance. They came. One of the cops from Princeton, he dared to get up there with Pete. And then the paramedics handed them the stretcher. They put me in the stretcher, strapped me in, and then handed me down, and off I went to the ER.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how long was your life in jeopardy after that?
The accident happened November 27th, and I was in the burn unit until, mid-February. And so the fact that you're in the burn unit, which is a very specialized place, not to be confused with anything in the natural world. You know, the fact that you're in there for however many months, 2.5 months or so, you're touch and go by virtue of you being in the burn unit. But I think from talking to my surgeons and blah, 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 I think we've pieced together that, and talking to my parents, the sort of news that they were getting along the way, I think the first month or so was sort of like, you know, give them a kiss goodnight, who knows where I'll be in the morning, essentially, you know. And I could have this a little bit wrong, but it was a while. It was many, many weeks and well into me being conscious. So I didn't, whether I knew that, I don't know, but I never really felt, interestingly or not, I didn't ever really think I was going to die. It was really only in retrospect, hearing a bunch of this stuff, where I said, wow, then the story started taking light in my mind. But while it was happening, no, it was just a scary, painful thing, but I didn't feel death's presence.
So the story that you've told, you've probably told that many times over the years. What do you feel when you tell it now? What is the experience of telling it years after the fact, having told it so many times?
Well, if you could see me now, Terry, you'd see a smile on my face. I mean, in part because it's just, I feel like I'm describing an exciting movie, and then you realize, oh, you're the character in that movie, and then if I'm honest, there's a little bit of pride, like, hey, I went through something, I survived something extremely intense, and blah blah blah. I mean, there's pride in retrospect. There's tons, and this actually one of the things that's taken years to really come to terms with is how grateful I am to Pete, to Jonathan, to Tommy, to the nurses, to my friend. I mean, on and on. We can talk about that. It's taken me years to let the full load of gratitude in. And that's been an interesting journey because that required me realizing how dependent on others I had become. And that was hard information to let in.
So you have prosthetics now, so you can walk, you bicycle, but for a while you were in a wheelchair and then a golf cart. Now your mother had polio. Yeah. I don't know if she's still alive or not.
She is.
Yeah. So I know throughout a lot of your life, and maybe still, she was using a wheelchair. What was her attitude toward wheelchairs, having seen your mother using one for so many years?
So this is a really key piece of the story for me, to have a mother with whom I'm very close, to grow up around disability from a young age, to have that carved into your sort of worldview was, you can imagine, right? Hugely helpful for me as a 19-year-old kid with ostensibly everything going for him. You know, you're at Princeton, blah, blah, blah. To know in your bones that you're on borrowed time with being, quote-unquote, able-bodied. I mean, I knew that. I didn't have to learn that. And that was a huge advantage. My mother, and watching her in such beauty and grace deal with her own disability. You know, so she had polio when she was 18 months, and then she had, when she hit about 40, as happens, she got what's called post-polio syndrome, and then became a progressive disability. And, you know, in my early childhood, she used crutches and a brace and was extremely physically capable. And then over time, from the early 80s on, it's just been a very slow decline to the point now where she really requires an electric wheelchair, has a little bit of ability to stand, but not for very long, et cetera. So being around, being close to a person, having that as a role model, having my mother as a role model, watching her deal with it, watching my father love her, watching how the world treated her, and this weird, and I got a lot of this too in the early 90s, you kind of, either people think you're Jesus because you've gone through something special. They treat you like this sort of, like you've got special knowledge, or they treat you a little bit like Frankenstein. Of course, those two responses are related. Neither of them is accurate, but that's the kind of vibe that a lot of us with disabilities know very well. And I had seen that. I knew how to read that thanks to my mother. It etc. So I can't make enough of how important that background was for me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. B.J. Miller. He's a hospice and palliative care doctor at the University of California, San Francisco Cancer Center, and he's co-author of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. We'll be right back after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. B.J. Miller. He's a hospice and palliative care doctor at the University of California, San Francisco Cancer Center, and co-author with Shoshana Berger of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. How did you decide that what you were going to do was become a hospice and palliative care doctor?
I started doing a little work in arts advocacy and disability rights. But basically, I realized, thanks to the disability rights movement, I realized that this, you know, disability is not something to be ashamed of. It's not something to overcome, to put behind you. It's something to work with, and it doesn't go away. I can't overcome this. It's my daily experience. So instead, find ways to, the compulsion was to work with it. And in a way that in a professional way that I could make a living. And medicine lit up as a, theoretically, as a way where I could use these experiences and pay them forward in some way or draw from them, not overcome them and put them behind me. And so I sort of said, well, I had nothing else I really wanted to do. So I said, oh, medicine makes good sense. Let's give it a try. And so I did. And the deal with myself was I'll either not be able to do it, and I don't, at this point, I knew enough about coming close to death to realize I didn't want to just sacrifice my life. It was too precious. So I said, if I don't like it, I'll stop. And if it's just too hard, I'll stop. But so down the road I went, and eventually I landed in a palliative care elective. And at that point, actually, I was about to get out of medicine. This was deep in senior year of med school. My sister had just died. There's a lot going on. We can talk about it. But bottom line is I was going to get out of medicine. I was very much disillusioned with and falling out of love with the idea. But then I stumbled onto a palliative care elective with the guys at the Medical College of Wisconsin where I was doing my internship. And everything just lit up in a day.
You mentioned that your sister had died at about the time you discovered palliative medicine.
Yeah.
She took her life. Mm-hmm. It was suicide. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, when I read that, I was thinking, you came so close to dying because of this horrible accident in which you were electrocuted. How did you handle knowing that she took her life, that she ended her life?
Yeah, it's a really, I'm still working on that one. It's still, but I think it has something to do with coming out of the backside of the experience of my own injuries, my own brush with death, etc. I didn't come out. I came out of there eventually holding life much more loosely. So it didn't teach me to cling to life with my fingernails, that was the way through. It taught me to sort of some adult trick of simultaneously holding on to opposing emotions. And one of the things, you know, grief does this, but, you know, if anyone has dealt with pain, chronic pain, you know, when the clouds part, even for a moment, and you have the absence of pain, it's a stunning feeling. And I remember feeling that I really wanted to stay close to that interface between joy and sorrow, between pain and pleasure, between life and death. It felt like such a rich, rich place that I had been forced into, that I, you know, I had to hang out there for a while, but I became a little enamored with it because from there, I could just as easily get to sorrow as I could get to joy. And that, to me, has felt like a kind of a dexterity or an agility, something very good. So death is close by, pain is close by, so is the rest of life, so is the good stuff. That zone, I can imagine, it helps me imagine what my patients are going through, being close to death. It helps me understand what my sister was feeling, perhaps. I guess my long-winded answer was, it's not as opposing as it might appear. My own fighting to live versus my own sister's, in a way, fighting to die. Those seem to be actually pretty darn closely related to me.
Did she have a mental illness?
She was posthumously diagnosed with one. I mean, Lisa was so friggin' smart. That was one of her problems. I mean, she was just she could get anyone thinking anything. And she ran hot like a furnace, hot and cold. And, you know, after she died, my parents went through her, you know, they made a controversial decision to look at her journals with a psychologist to try to make sense of what had happened. And through that, they hit very plainly on the diagnosis of bipolar depression,
mm-hmm.
Manic depression, however you want to call it. And it was odd. I mean, I was a med school trainee. I mean, it's so, in her case, it's outrageously plain. It's so incredibly, incredibly obvious. But somehow we all missed it, including her therapist of a gazillion years. She was just too clever.
So getting back to your pain, your physical pain, I'm sure you were on a lot of opioids
mm-hmm.
in the recovery period. What did you learn as a palliative care doctor from your own experiences dealing with severe pain and dealing with the opioids that helped you survive the pain?
How powerful pain relief is, how important it is. How powerful it is and how much caution it requires. You know, there's all of that. But I think the more interesting thing and much more relevant to my work now and to the work of hospice and palliative medicine just period is that, you know, pain is very interesting. It's not, you know, when I was coming out, this phantom limb pain, which I had, that was considered like a psychiatric phenomenon. They've since learned, but it's just a case in point of how just fascinating pain is and how it affects your identity, how you see yourself, your mood, what you think of God. I mean, it is a thorough phenomenon, and that's where it gets very interesting. And that's why I think hospice and palliative medicine is so interesting. You don't just treat pain, you treat suffering. Suffering is a multi-headed beast.
Wait, I'm going to stop you there. What do you see as the difference between pain and suffering? Because I think that's an interesting distinction.
Mm. Well, to back up for a second, just for your listeners, so palliative care, it's basically palliative care is the treatment of suffering versus the rest of medicine sort of the treatment of disease. In palliative care, we treat suffering. And hospice is that sort of treatment of suffering specific to the end of life. But palliative care writ large is just a treatment of suffering anytime along the way of a serious illness. You don't have to be dying anytime soon to get it. Okay, so that just to get clear what the heck palliative care is. Now, okay, so what is suffering? Well, suffering, there's a lot of different ways to define it. Cicely Saunders, for the grandmother of hospice work, she called it total pain, that it had a physical component, a psychological and emotional component, a spiritual component. It's a multi-headed entity. It affects, one might say, it affects how you see yourself. It affects your identity. I've come to understand suffering as this, like as a wedge, that something that a gap that opens up in you, the gap between the world you have and the world you want. So it gets at your desire. It gets at your longing. It gets at what you're lacking. It's just. So you might as well see a priest as you would a doctor to treat your suffering.
So one of the things you learned from your pain was that you could treat the pain, but there's also an emotional and spiritual element too, mm-hmm. components of suffering that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. That's right. that was not simply just trying to deaden the stimulus. And that suffering, by leaning into it, by working with it, by being changed by it, by learning from it, it's a very humbling experience. It makes you, it helps you, makes you see things a little differently. And I guess there's a humility in it. But there's also this sort of way, so if you open it up like this, the ways to treat it become much more interesting. Like studying art was a way to treat suffering. You know? Becoming a physician was a way to treat suffering. These were ways to make meaning. And as we know, making meaning from your experience is a real salve. I mean, that is itself a treatment. So it just, yeah, it just explodes the subject and makes it much more dynamic. But also, very, very importantly, much more universal.
My guest is B.J. Miller, a hospice and palliative care doctor at the University of California San Francisco Cancer Center. He's the co-author of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End. After a short break, we'll talk about why he asks terminally ill patients if what they're afraid of is dying or being dead. And book critic Maureen Corrigan will tell us what's on her list of the best books of the year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Echo, publisher of Olaf Olafsson's new novel, The Sacrament. A nun's past returns to her when she and a former student investigate the death of a priest and a series of abuse claims at a Catholic school in Iceland. Available now. And from the Pajamagram Company, creators of matching holiday pajamas for the whole family, including dogs and cats, with Charlie Brown, Star Wars, and Grinch themes, in knits, fleece, and flannel. Available at pajamagram.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with B.J. Miller, a hospice and palliative care doctor at the University of California San Francisco Cancer Center. He's the former executive director of the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. He got into this work because he came close to dying when he was 19, after he climbed on top of a small shuttle train parked for the night and got electrocuted. He lost both legs below the knees and half an arm. He's written a new book with Shoshana Berger called A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. And he started a new project, the Center for Dying and Living. Currently, it's a website designed for people to share their own stories related to living with illness, disability, and loss, or caring for those who are. Let's get back to suffering. So
yep.
Since, as you said, like suffering has like not only a physical pain, but an emotional and spiritual aspect to it. As you pointed out, you know, some drugs can speak to some of that emotional and spiritual suffering, even if it might be an artificial dialogue, a drug-induced dialogue, it still speaks to it. So I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about drugs at the end of life. You know, if you have a terminal illness, especially if you have a very limited time left, not only opioids, but also there's been experiments with like LSD and with MDMA, especially for people who are afraid of death, with the idea that these drugs can sometimes induce a state of transcendence that will make you look at your life and maybe look at death a little bit differently. I don't know how much of experience, I know you've had a lot of experience with treating people with opioids. I'm not sure if you've participated in any of the other experiments or not, but do you have any direct experience in dealing with people near death who are using MDMA or psilocybin or LSD?
I do. Both above board as research subjects and people who are doing it informally.
So what have you actually witnessed?
I have witnessed, I've not been around them per se having those experiences. I have been around them to see the effects of those experiences. And what you meet afterwards is not someone who, you know, they're still very much themselves. They are just, there's a certain peace and even a sort of playfulness. Like, it's almost like you can learn how to fall apart. Like you can learn how to fall. I've known this experience. There's something there to harness. You can kind of take yourself down to the studs. So when I've talked to folks before and after these experiences, you know, at once is the person goes from anxious to at peace, from seeing themselves as totally isolated to feeling themselves totally connected. And again, these are not thrill seekers. These are folks who are had serious issues and come out with one experience feeling a heck of a lot better.
And are these people who've had guided experiences as opposed to just like taking street drugs on their own?
Yeah. Everyone I've known who's done this has taken it very seriously. Some have been test subject in a research study, and some have followed protocols more casually, informally with friends or others who are doing this kind of work on the side or underground.
But doing it in a safe, guided setting.
But this is a hugely important point, Terry, right? These same drugs are very powerful and can lead people astray if it's not set. And setting is very important. How the intentions you go into this experience with are very important. The integration, how you come out of this experience and integrate it back into your daily life. These are really important pieces of the puzzle. You're not going to get that at a rock concert then it's a much riskier affair.
So earlier we were talking about how, before you got into this field, when you were a student at Princeton, you were electrocuted after you climbed on top of a train that was not in use, but still you got electrocuted and lost your legs below the knees and half of one arm. And then you got into palliative care and hospice work. I'm wondering now, when you introduce yourself to patients for the first time, if they don't already know of you, because I'm sure in many situations your reputation precedes you, but if they don't already know of you, and earlier in your career when they didn't know of you, did you try to let them know right away that you'd kind of almost been there yourself? Did you show them your prosthetics? Did you tell them your story to give them a sense of like, I get it. I mean, I don't know your specifics yet, but I understand pain, and I understand what it's like to come close to death, although that's different from having a terminal illness.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is where I've gotten to a place where I'm very grateful to have an obvious disability. You know, early on, if I could have hidden it, I certainly would have. But part of my own therapy was the fact that I couldn't hide it, and it made me deal with it. And so, in answer to your question, you know, because the legs are very obvious, and I don't wear these covers on the legs or cosmetic covers. I mean, you look at them, and there's no confusing them with natural legs.
You have those, like, metal prosthetics?
Yep. Yeah, they're carbon fiber blades. You know, they're kind of futuristic looking, but like I say, not to be confused with natural.
They really look like they get the job done. I've seen people, like, mountain climbing with them and doing all kinds of things.
They are amazing. This is where, you know, as an injury, in contrast to my mother's, right, who has a progressive decline, it's only going to get worse. Mine, thanks to the technology, you can expect to actually get better and better. It's very different. But anyway, the point here is that you take one look at me and there's no, you know something's gone. Just my silhouette alone. So very often with patients, we don't end up talking about my story much because what they need is obvious enough. And what they seem to need is empathy, right? You know, they seem to need someone who understands enough what it's like to be in the bed, to be dependent on others, to go through this crazy healthcare system, et cetera. And that's just obvious in 2 seconds of meeting. So very often we don't end up having to talk about it. I'm certainly open to talking about it, but it doesn't seem necessary.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. B.J. Miller. He's a hospice and palliative care doctor at the University of California, San Francisco Cancer Center, and now he's the co-author of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. And from the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. B.J. Miller. He's a hospice and palliative care doctor at the University of California, San Francisco Cancer Center, and co-author of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. I know when you're working with people who are terminally ill and are nearing death, you ask them about their fear, and you differentiate between the fear of dying and the fear of being dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask them which, if either they're afraid of. Can you talk about the difference between the two and why you frame the question that way?
Yeah, well, so fear is such a bear, and it's also such a normal thing. I think one thing about the fear of death, sort of existential fear and dread, and you know, it's a fear to look at, not a run away from. It's a particular fear, and why I say that is, fear helps point you to the things that you care about, to the things you love, the things you're afraid to lose. Anyway, fear is a big, important subject and really requires and demands looking at. The sooner we do, the better. Because oftentimes it's not so darn scary. So to your question, it's helpful when patients will confess some fear to me, is to really look at it, get down and roll around with it. So, and very often it comes down to that when pushed, people say, yeah, actually I'm afraid of the pain I imagine is going to happen during the dying process. So the fear of dying, the fear of the dying process. Now that's an important distinction because any hospice and palliative medicine team can do a lot to quell the pain and the sorrow that happens during the dying process. There, we have medications. We have ways of being with each other. We have ways of positioning your body. There's all sorts of things to do. So suffering is not necessarily part of the dying process. And there's a lot of reassurance. Like we understand that process pretty well, and there's a lot we can do. So that's an important distinction. That's pretty concrete. That's knowable. Now, some of my patients will say, no, yeah, that's one thing, but now I'm actually afraid of being dead. I'm afraid of being in the ground. I'm afraid of what comes next or whatever else. And then we get to say, and then my response, of course, is, well, gosh, I don't know what that's like either, but let's think about it. Let's talk about it. And when we push on that one, I think most of us can get to a place where we realize that we're not just our bodies, and our bodies, once they're dead, aren't likely to be feeling anything. But when you push on that one, you can open up, you know, what ends up often being this modern acronym of FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. That's very often at the heart of people's fear of being dead. Like all that they're going to miss, and this idea that the world's going to continue on without them, all the things are not going to get to see, etc. But if you go there, Terry, well, then what has that done? That's just pointed us very squarely to all the things we love and care about. And then that becomes a nice compass for our way forward, how we're going to live until we die. And so the fears there, the things that we're going to afraid to miss, are the things that really we should uptick in terms of our attention now. So these are a couple ways you get to kind of work with this fear and find a way through.
You must have seen so many people go through the dying process over the years you've been a palliative care and hospice doctor. What does your experience tell you about whether dying is an inherently frightening experience?
I think, well, from my experience, dying is not an inherently frightening experience. It's, I think, for us neurotic animal humans, it's more terrifying in anticipation. You know, with enough support, most of the people that I've been around who are actually doing the dying, they get to a place where they're, you know, ready to go. That doesn't necessarily mean it's fun and light, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily all miserable either. In some ways, it's a great relief. I think, like so many things, the anticipation of it can be way worse than being in it. And in this way, it's also harder on the family, harder on those who have to stay behind. And these aren't absolute rules, but that's basically a gist of what I've seen.
Having seen as many deaths as you have, do you ever risk feeling like kind of numb to it? You know, like you have a new patient who's facing death for the first time. You've ushered so many people through the process and cared for them during the process. Do you ever fear you're going to feel like, yeah, been there, done that, you're somebody else is going to die soon? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I think this is one of the occupational... We mentioned one occupational hazard earlier, which is that so much of this work is empathy-driven. I mean, suffering, this is all very subjective stuff. But if you're empathic and if you're around people who are suffering, you're going to feel their suffering one way or another. So that's a big occupational hazard, is that you can just get laden with pain that's not just your own. And the other occupational hazard is you get inured to it, you know, that you... seduce yourself accidentally or otherwise into thinking, oh, I've seen it. I know what death is like. I've been there. I've been around it. And even in my own personal experiences, as close as I've gotten to my own death and those around me, it's really, I'm very disciplined about maintaining a little coefficient, a little corrective variable that says, yeah, I've seen these things. I've seen patterns. But I reserve the right, when it is my time to go, when I'm actually dying, not this partial death stuff that I've had, I reserve the right to freak out. You know, part of this is mystery, and I just wrote a book with Shoshana. Shoshana and I just wrote a book on this whole subject, right? And we, us implying we have some expertise, but part of that expertise is knowing the limits of what we know. And there's all sorts of things I don't know. That's why I love my agnosticism. I love mystery. But to your question, no, I think one of the real hazard, if I find myself getting a little numb and a little, you know, yawning at the idea of death, I shake myself. And I remind myself there's all sorts of stuff I don't know, I don't see. And so far that's been enough, just little reminders.
So your new book is a kind of a guidebook for people to help them prepare for death and get their things in order, so that their loved ones don't inherit a mess, you know, either like a messy home or a messy will or no will at all or no instructions about what to do with the body. Or any of that. And one of the things that you recommend in the book is a death file, mm-hmm. a kind of file with like all of the relevant records and the wills and the DNRs mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. is relevant to your loved ones to see after you're gone. And at what point do you recommend getting that together? And do you already have one?
Mm. Yeah, the When I Die file. Shoshana and I were talking early on about this sort of idea of how to kind of collate
this is your
all
co-author.
This gear. Yeah, Shoshana is my co-author. Hi, Shoshana. We initially she caught herself saying calling it the If I Die file. We all and we had to gently correct each other that no, when I die files. It's the when I die files, the way we call it. But whatever, it could be a shoebox. But just make it easy for the people who survive you to find the stuff, find your passwords to all your online junk, so that they can close your, you know, Facebook account, and they can turn off your cable and all this other stuff. I mean, honestly, people have to go through months and years without that stuff. It takes years to wind down the physical residue of a life. So, yeah, make a file. Put in it, like, your advance directive, your will, your instructions for how you'd want to be buried. You can be very detailed. Do you want a certain music played at your funeral? Do you want certain people there? Do you want certain people not there? All that kind of stuff, you know, and it can be fun too. Like a friend of ours, Ira Byock, he talks about how his mother left him a bunch of recipes, and what a beautiful legacy that was. You can leave notes to family members. You know, one of the things that's been beautiful I've watched people do is that there's sort of legacy work that goes on. My friend Frisch Brandt here in San Francisco, she writes letters with folks. So she'll sit with folks who are dying and write letters to unborn grandchildren or kids before, you know, on their graduation or hypothetical wedding days, you know, that kind of thing. It'd be gorgeous. Or you can record it and put it in this box. This is a way to actually kind of help you wrap your head around your own mortality, get creative with it to the degree you want to. And also, as importantly, and perhaps most importantly, it makes it so, so much easier for your heirs to know what you want, to know what's important to you, and to enter their grief filled with some more of a beautiful, cleaner sorrow than a guilt-ridden or task-laden affair.
P.J. Miller, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Terry, it has been such a joy. Thank you.
B.J. Miller is the co-author of the new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End. He's a hospice and palliative care doctor at the University of California, San Francisco Cancer Center. After we take a short break, book critic Maureen Corrigan will go through her list of the best books of the year. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has put together her list of the best books of the year, and it's a mix of books by authors old and new. Here's her top 10.
There's a lot to talk about, so let's just get into it. Here are my top 10 books of 2019. The Nickel Boys is yet another extraordinary novel by Colson Whitehead. Like The Underground Railroad, which just came out in 2016, The Nickel Boys is rooted in history and American mythology, yet it's painfully topical in its vision of justice and mercy erratically denied. In the early 1960s, an African-American teenager named Elwood Curtis finds himself wrongfully convicted of a crime and sent to a brutal reform school called The Nickel Academy. Whitehead's novel is short and intense, its chapters as compact as the isolation cells the nickel boys are thrown into and sometimes never leave. Susan Choi's Trust Exercise is a deliciously sharp and self-aware novel set in the 1980s in a performing arts high school. Two first-year students, David and Sarah, fall in love within the hermetically sealed world of the school, and Choi somehow makes out of that teenaged affair a wily meditation on memory and art. Choi tells us that the theater students live by the adage, acting is fidelity to authentic emotion under imagined circumstances. That's also not a bad description of how this novel, or any powerful novel, works. Any year in which a new novel by Ann Patchett comes out is a standout year in my book. The Dutch House is a subtle, devastating novel about a brother and sister who stand by each other through the loss of their parents, the home they grew up in, and the bedrock certainties about their shared childhood. I'm not exaggerating when I say that I've reread the ending of this novel at least 5 times, trying to unpack its sad magic. Out of all the novels that came out in 2019, Lost and Wanted by Nell Freudenberger is the one that I found myself buying over and over again to give to friends. Its main character, Helen Clapp, is a professor of physics at MIT. And when the story opens, her cell phone rings and an old friend's name comes up on caller ID. The problem is that friend has just died. From that classic creeper premise, Freudenberger crafts a deeply engaging novel about friendship, midlife puzzlement, and the mysteries of the universe. Like Freudenberger, Karen Russell always has her eye on the big picture. Orange World is Russell's latest short story collection, and it contains a masterpiece. That story, set in the Great Depression, is called The Prospectors. In 33 incandescent pages, Russell gives us the grit, desperation, and hollow dreams of deliverance that characterized that era. The other 7 stories in this collection aren't so bad either. Poet Ocean Vuong emigrated to this country from Vietnam when he was 2, and his autobiographical novel called On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous explores the vexed situation of a child who surpasses his immigrant parents. Vuong's novel is structured in the form of a letter written by a son to his illiterate mother. "Dear Ma," the novel begins, "I am writing to reach you, even if each word I put down is one word further from where you are." In that single line, Vuong has captured the unintended rift that education can cause within a working-class immigrant family. On to nonfiction. Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe is a panoramic investigation into the disappearance of a young widowed mother of 10 in Belfast, Northern Ireland in 1972, the era of the Troubles. Say Nothing belongs as much to the genre of narrative history as it does true crime. However you want to characterize it, it's a stunning book. The Yellow House by Sarah M. Broom is a sweeping, multi-generational memoir, focusing on her family's house in New Orleans, which was blown off its foundations when Hurricane Katrina hit. Broom pieces together a larger narrative about race, class, and the long-term toxic consequences of shame. 2019 was a very good year for essay collections, but of all the ones I've read, Emily Bernard's Black is the Body stays with me the most. Bernard writes with depth, poetic intensity, and humor about growing up Black in the South and living and teaching in the snow globe state of Vermont. Bernard's personal essays on race never hew to the safe or expected paths. And last, but certainly not least, in How We Fight for Our Lives, Saeed Jones writes about growing up Black, gay, and isolated in Texas. Jones's voice and sensibility are so distinct, he turns the traditional coming-of-age memoir inside out and upside down. Along with Sarah Broom and Ocean Vuong, Saeed Jones is one of the three debut prose writers on my top 10 list, which is a hopeful thing to take notice of, I think, as we move into the next decade.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find her top 10 list on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find a link to NPR's Book Concierge, which includes hundreds of 2019 titles recommended by NPR staff and critics. So that's at freshair.npr.org. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about what happens to the clothes, furniture, and electronics you drop off at the thrift store. More specifically, what happens to the stuff they can't sell? And there's plenty of it. My guest will be Adam Minter, author of the book Secondhand. Three generations of his family were in the junk business. He's reported on waste and recycling for nearly two decades. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, developing ways to use the PD-L1 pathway in immunotherapy to treat cancer. Committed to making contributions in cancer treatment for 72 years. DanaFarber.org/everywhere.